This is Lover Alternative News. I'm Jim Burr. Cuba's Organic Food Revolution Flourishing by Eliza Barclay. Across the Florida Straits from Miami, in the capital city of a country ranked 90th in GDP by the United Nations Development Program, students in Havana, Cuba are munching on a wide variety of fresh fruits and vegetables picked by their own hands in the school garden or grown nearby in urban organic gardens. In the early 1990s, the average Cuban dinner table did not boast a spread even remotely close to the bounty enjoyed by many today. During these years, when foreign economic support disappeared with the collapse of the Soviet Union, average caloric and protein intake dropped to nearly 30% below 1980s levels. Faced with the possibility of widespread starvation, the Cuban government foresaw that a full-scale mobilization of domestic resources, both human and natural, would be required in order to increase production to meet the demands of a hungry populace. And with few options to import food, given the stringency of the U.S. embargo, Cuba turned over a new leaf by converting almost entirely to an organic production system within 10 years. Cuba's nationwide commitment to food self-sufficiency, without reliance on chemical or mechanical technologies, has borne some startlingly successful results, not only in terms of food production, but also in the development of a more personalized food culture, woven deeply into patterns of food consumption, nutrition, and community. These trends, which many sustainable agriculture experts enthusiastically champion, also appear to be on the brink of a major confrontation with the powerful forces of the global market, from which Cuba was virtually exempt until 2001, when U.S. policy toward agricultural exports to Cuba began to shift slightly. The strength of Cuba's food security, with all its growing bureaucratic and market support, will inevitably be put to the test as small but increasing concessions are made to expand trade between Cuba and its closest potential trading partner, the United States. In 1989, as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the subsequent retraction of petroleum, farm equipment, food subsidies, and the preferential trade relationship that had come with Soviet support of the Cuban state, the country lapsed into a phase of dire food, energy, and morale shortages known as the Special Period, or Periodo Especial. Cuba had been under the thumb of various colonial empires from Spain and the United States since the 16th century. The Soviet Union, during its phase of supporting Cuba, continued with a system that encouraged the production of sugar and tobacco for foreign markets, leaving little land for food production. In 1999, however, no one came to scoop up the Caribbean island and label in more subsidies, and the Cubans felt a new sense of excision from the global market. Cubans from all walks of life suffered during this period. Shortages were reminiscent of wartime, though the country was diplomatically at peace. The crisis was worsened by the tightening of the U.S. trade embargo through two pieces of legislation in 1992 and 1996, zapping any possibility of Cuba looking outside its boundaries for assistance, except to a few friendly governments like Venezuela and Nicaragua. The agricultural model inherited from the 1980s was not a particularly advantageous one. Farming in Cuba before the special period was characterized by large quantities of chemical inputs and a highly monocultural intensive system. In this period, Cuban farms had been using roughly 200 kilograms of nitrates per hectare. Without the Soviets delivering these expensive inputs at subsidized rates, Cuban farmers and average hungry citizens had no choice but to look to alternative models in developing a new agricultural system. After 10 years of hard work and major food shortages, most Cubans can feel secure in having access to fresh, nutritious food through the extensive network of intensively cultivated urban gardens, or organoponicos, and state-run farms and cooperatives outside the cities. They can also take comfort in the fact that nearly all the food they eat comes from a self-sufficient agricultural system that relies only minimally on pesticides, fertilizers, or expensive machinery. Given the highly restrictive nature of the U.S. embargo on trade with and from Cuba, the Cubans have been forced to virtually sink or swim in terms of procuring or growing food. Because of the terms of the trade sanctions, Cuba has been ineligible to receive food aid from international aid agencies. Peter Rossett, co-director of Food First, Institute for Food and Development Policy, based in Oakland, California, has been researching food issues in Cuba since the early 1990s. He said, Cuba has resisted three things: the blockade of the U.S. embargo, the fallout of the Soviet Union, and the industrial green revolution and economic globalization that has taken its toll elsewhere in the world. Fortunately, with a combination of solid scientific expertise and institutional will, Cuba was able to replace conventional farming practices with more practical and affordable alternatives. By charting new courses in research, land management, and market supply, government officials and scientists were able to avert a full hunger crisis and activate farmers and urban citizens to dedicate themselves to meeting food demands. Key ingredients in the new agricultural model are the urban agriculture movement, traditional farming techniques like composting and intercropping, growing two crops together that benefit each other by warding off particular pests. New non-toxic biopesticides and biofertilizers, worker managed collectives, quotas for farmers to ensure adequate supply for the whole country, and opening farmers markets where excess food crops can be sold by farmers for profit. The government also addressed land availability for domestic food production by redistributing parcels of land that had formerly operated as cane plantations for the sugar industry, which exchanged its products for oil from the Soviet Union. Each of these initiatives has created a fertile environment for technological innovation in organic production and economic incentives that encourage more people to farm. According to Rosset, Cuba has been able to change farming techniques in order to survive, but it has been an ongoing process of institutionalizing the farming alternatives. Throughout the past decade, government agencies like the Ministries of Agriculture, Health, Education, and Communication have been developing increasingly coordinated efforts to integrate agricultural extension education, nutrition education, and outreach to the Cuban people. The government has committed to make fresh fruits and vegetables available to every citizen, but so far they haven't quite managed to do this. Cuban authorities say that at this point, availability is not so much of an issue. Instead, they are now working on ways to bring down the prices so that even the poorest consumers can enjoy the bounty. Cuba's commitment to sustainable farming practices demonstrates how huge improvements in food production can be achieved even under stressful economic and environmental conditions. Urban agriculture has played an integral role in achieving food security, and Cuba is at the vanguard of the global urban agriculture movement. In 2002, Cuba produced 3.2 million tons of food in urban farms and gardens. In 2002, more than 35,000 hectares, 86,450 acres, of urban land were dedicated to the intensive production of fresh fruits, vegetables, and spices. According to Dr. Nelson Campagnoni Concepcion, Deputy Director of the National Institute for Fundamental Research on Tropical Agriculture, the goal of urban agriculture is to gain the most food from every square meter of available space. The secret to the success of urban agriculture in Cuba has been the introduction of new technologies and varieties and an increase in areas farmed. Another factor favoring urban agriculture is that Cuba does not have the transport infrastructure, especially since the Soviets stopped delivering fuel to deliver large quantities of food from rural areas to the cities on a regular basis. This means that urban residents benefit not only from feeding themselves, but also by guaranteeing the freshness of their daily sustenance. Extra food is shared in the community. Retirement home and hospital kitchens receive anywhere from a steady supply to seasonal fluctuating donations from neighborhood gardens. These gardens, coupled with comprehensive rural and suburban farms, play a critical role in completing the sense of food security that Cubans now enjoy. Filberto Zamora, the administrator of one of the oldest organoponicos in Havana, which won recognition from President Fidel Castro, said, "This organoponico is very much a part of the neighborhood. We give food to the school two blocks away, and all the neighbors come to buy the food from the stand." Zamora's organoponico grows bok choy, lettuces, and cilantro, but farmers from outlying areas of Havana are also allowed to sell their produce at Zamora's stand. The organoponico facility has also begun to produce its own seeds and compost for distribution to other farms in Havana. The farm stands and neighborhood gardens have not only provided a consistent source of fresh and affordable food, but the fact that fresh produce is now readily available has also played a critical role in guiding the Cuban diet in a more healthy direction. After the special period, once food was plentiful again, people were stuffing their faces with foods like meats and sugars that they had been deprived of, said Madeline Vasquez Galvez, owner of El Bambu, a vegetarian restaurant outside Havana, and editor of Germinal, a journal that focuses on food education for sustainability. "We now know that there are many diseases associated with diets high in sugar and fat." Vasquez has been involved with ecological cuisine in Cuba for 11 years. Her cooking style utilizes a wide range of native fruits and vegetables grown in the restaurant's own permaculture garden. Permaculture is an approach that emphasizes holistic design and maintenance so that the food system mirrors a biologically productive ecosystem. In other parts of the restaurant as well, Vasquez sticks to ecological principles. For example, her stoves are powered by solar panels. The Cuban diet has not always included copious amounts of vegetables, especially not those of the leafy green persuasion. As strange as it seems to some Cubans, especially the older generations whose diets have primarily depended on Soviet subsidies, vegetables appear to be catching on. There are now 9 vegetarian restaurants in Havana, and urban gardeners from all walks of life expound upon the importance of fresh food. The government and market have worked together to both feed the people and nurture the soil, and so diversity in diet has evolved, mirroring the crop diversity in the field. In the past few years, the Ministry of Health has become strongly supportive of and involved with urban gardening and the diversification of the Cuban diet. Zamora said, "It is still too early to determine where the new program of educating children on the healthy aspects of vegetables is really having an impact on their concept of what tastes good. We do find, though, that they want vegetables just as much as their parents when they come to the stand. The news of Cuba's success has been slowly leaking out since the early 1990s, and the country is beginning to take on legendary status as a model for sustainable agriculture and local food production in the eyes of environmental advocates, farmers, and development specialists. Already lauded for years by the steady stream of sustainable farming gurus from around the world who have made the pilgrimage to observe the success of organic and local food production, Cuba's experiment with sustainable agriculture has succeeded beyond its trial period. American farmers have been shuttled to Cuba in fact-finding missions and reality tours by crafty NGOs who have obtained the highly coveted U.S. Department of Treasury Office of Foreign Assets Control licenses, allowing them to sponsor travel to Cuba for educational purposes. Whether many of these trips will be allowed to continue is unclear. In March 2003, OFAC announced the end of people-to-people exchanges. Most groups who have had the appropriate licenses are scheduled to lose them by December 2003. But a rapidly approaching future of shifting economic opportunities poses serious questions and potential risks to this Cuba's model, regarded as precious by so many of its advocates. Despite the embargo in 2000, President Clinton signed the Trade Sanctions Reform and Export Enhancement Act, which reauthorized the direct commercial export of food products and agricultural products via cash transactions from the United States to Cuba, but not from Cuba to the United States. In September 2002, after the U.S. Food and Agribusiness Exhibition took place in Havana, the Cuban government purchased more than $91.9 million in food and agricultural products from subsidiaries of U.S. companies based in Latin America and Canada, and directly from U.S. companies. Archer Daniels Midland, one of the world's largest exporters of cereal grains and oilseeds, signed a $19 million contract for soybean oil, soybeans, soy proteins, corn, margarine, and rice. In 2001, ADM's lobbying, combined with wreckage in Cuba after Hurricane Michelle, was the tipping point that persuaded the Bush administration to allow the first sale of goods directly from the United States to Cuba since 1962. The American Corn Growers Association, which to date has not taken up trade negotiations with Cuba, would be interested in trade sometime in the future, said its chief executive officer. "We should be exporting to any nation that needs food," said CEO Larry Mitchell. With Cuba's well-documented ability to feed itself, why would the Cuban government be interested in spending $91.9 million on food imports? John S. Kavalich II, president of the U.S. Trade and Economic Council based in New York City, said, "There's a strong political component to the Cubans' decision to purchase food products from us. Of the products purchased since 2001, nearly all of them are available from other sources at better prices." Kavalich cited rice as an example. The Cubans could buy rice from Vietnam at a significantly lower price, but they choose to purchase from purveyors like ADM instead. Food First's Rossett agrees, "I believe the Cubans are buying from the U.S. as a political gesture. They hope the food corporations will lobby the U.S. government on their behalf to lift the embargo." Aside from the disruption in self-sufficiency, there is also growing concern that if the embargo is eventually lifted, global agricultural giants will persuade farmers to drop their organic methods in favor of high pesticide and fertilizer usage. However, Dr. Nelson Campagnoni Concepcion of INIFAT responded, "We are not going back. We will increase production, but we will not degrade the environment doing it." Speculating on the possible institutional reactions to a global market that peddles genetically engineered seeds, pesticides, and fertilizers, Rossett said, "There is a possibility of a negative impact on the Cuban model. There may be a short-term increase in pesticide use and a stronger interest in biotechnology, but they may not last because they may not fulfill Cuban agricultural needs." The members of the U.S. Trade and Economic Council, Incorporated, seem to be chomping at the Cuban market bit. Kavalich said, "We have many members who have begun discussions with the Cubans over a wide array of products like food and hospitality services and biotech products. As of now, the only McDonald's in Cuba is located on the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base, which has belonged to the United States since 1934. Cuban fast food chains exist and are popular, but they do not dominate the landscape or pepper the national concept of food, largely because advertising does not exist. If McDonald's in the U.S. produce corn, peas, and carrots in a can are eventually allowed into Cuba, it will still be up to the Cubans whether they prefer the foreign food to their own backyard-grown papayas, yucca, and lettuce." Cancun targets cotton. It's not often you see Africans looking like potential big winners at big international gatherings. But this week, François Traoré, the head of Burkina Faso's National Cotton Producers Union, has been positively beaming and at center stage at the World Trade Organization's meeting in Cancun. He is part of the West African delegation that has managed, much to the chagrin of United States trade negotiators, to make cotton a test case of the WTO's commitment to a level playing field for trade in agricultural goods. It is a fitting test case, and it is up to the Bush administration to address the Africans' legitimate demands and give the trade talks a significant boost. Burkina Faso is one of four major West African cotton producers, all of which have long complained that their farmers are being unfairly cut out of the international market by subsidized American cotton. Farmers of many products in poor countries have the same complaints about the way wealthy countries rig the trade game. The fact that cotton is the only commodity to be singled out by the WTO at Cancun may, as Washington certainly believes, have to do with the fact that Europeans grow very little cotton. The United States is the principal culprit, and there is an element of ganging up on Uncle Sam at play. There was certainly something cheeky about officials from the European Union, whose subsidies for farm products generally exceed those of the United States, cheering on the Africans' proposal. That said, there are plenty of substantive reasons for singling out cotton. America's lavish handouts to its cotton farmers, which can reach $3 billion a year, hurt some of the world's poorest nations by driving world cotton prices below the cost of production. It is one commodity in which these least developed nations would clearly have a competitive advantage in the absence of America's unfair trade practices. Washington is understandably having a hard time defending a program that costs taxpayers billions to keep 25,000 cotton growers, most of them politically powerful and quite wealthy, in business. The surplus created by this absurd form of rural workfare is then dumped on world markets at a grievous cost to 10 million West African cotton farmers. This is about feeding our people and getting our children to school, said Fatou Aglobkhan, Benin's Minister of Commerce and Industry. The Africans' Cotton Initiative, formally debated late on the first day of the gathering in Cancun, a Mexican seaside resort, calls on the United States and others to agree now, as opposed to waiting for the end of this round of trade talks next year, to abolish their cotton subsidies within the next 3 years and to compensate poor cotton-producing nations harmed by these subsidies in the interim. The need to do something to address the suffering of cotton growers in sub-Saharan Africa has such strong moral appeal that the WTO's own Secretary General, Supachai Panichpakdi from Thailand, took the unusual step of chiming in that he thought the proposal had a lot of merit. Once dismissive of the Africans' Cotton Initiative, the American delegation at Cancun is now scrambling to head it off. The Americans are proposing a grandiose but vague plan to support the African cotton and textile industries in all kinds of other ways. The African ministers seem amused at Washington's sudden interest in helping them build a stronger textile industry, and reasonably regarded as an effort to change the subject from the subsidy issue. Washington could strike a deal without labeling it a compensation scheme. Its more churlish concerns about conceding on this before the Europeans and others make any concessions need to be abandoned. The United States would go a long way toward reclaiming its moral leadership on trade matters if it reached a deal on cotton with the Africans while still at Cancun. The End of Zionism by Avraham Berg. The Zionist revolution has always rested on two pillars, a just path and an ethical leadership. Neither of these is operative any longer. The Israeli nation today rests on a scaffolding of corruption and on foundations of oppression and injustice. As such, the end of the Zionist enterprise is already on our doorstep. There is a real chance that ours will be the last Zionist generation. There may yet be a Jewish state here, but it will be a different sort, strange and ugly. There is time to change course, but not much. What is needed is a new vision of a just society and the political will to implement it. Diaspora Jews, for whom Israel is a central pillar of their identity, must pay heed and speak out. The opposition does not exist, and the coalition, with Ariel Sharon at its head, claims the right to remain silent. In a nation of chatterboxes, everyone has suddenly fallen dumb because there's nothing left to say. We live in a thunderously failed reality. Yes, we have revived the Hebrew language, created a marvelous theater, and a strong national currency. Our Jewish minds are as sharp as ever. We are traded on the NASDAQ. But is this why we created a state? The Jewish people did not survive for two millennia in order to pioneer new weaponry, computer security programs, or anti-missile missiles. We were supposed to be a light unto the nations. In this, we have failed. It turns out that the 2,000-year struggle for Jewish survival comes down to a state of settlements run by an amoral clique of corrupt lawbreakers who are deaf both to their citizens and to their enemies. A state lacking justice cannot survive. More and more Israelis are coming to understand this as they ask their children where they expect to live in 25 years. Children who are honest admit, to their parents' shock, that they do not know. The countdown to the end of Israeli society has begun. It is very comfortable to be a Zionist in West Bank settlements such as Beit El and Ofra. The biblical landscape is charming. You can gaze through the geraniums and bougainvilleas and not see the occupation. Traveling on the fast highway that skirts barely a half mile west of the Palestinian roadblocks, it's hard to comprehend the humiliating experience of the despised Arab who must creep for hours along the packed, blockaded roads assigned to him. One road for the occupier, one road for the occupied. This cannot work. Even if the Arabs lower their heads and swallow their shame and anger forever, it won't work. A structure built on human callousness will inevitably collapse in on itself. Note this moment well. Zionism's superstructure is already collapsing like a cheap Jerusalem wedding hall. Only madmen continue dancing on the top floor while the pillars below are collapsing. We have grown accustomed to ignoring the suffering of the women at the roadblocks. No wonder we don't hear the cries of the abused women living next door, or the single mother struggling to support her children in dignity. We don't even bother to count the women murdered by their husbands. Israel, having ceased to care about the children of the Palestinians, should not be surprised when they come washed in hatred and blow themselves up in the centers of Israeli escapism. They consign themselves to Allah and our places of recreation because their own lives are torture. They spill their own blood in our restaurants in order to ruin our appetites because they have children and parents at home who are hungry and humiliated. We could kill 1,000 ringleaders a day and nothing will be solved because the leaders come up from below, from the wells of hatred and anger, from the infrastructures of injustice and moral corruption. If all this were inevitable, divinely ordained, and immutable, I would be silent. But things could be different, and so crying out is a moral imperative. Here's what the Prime Minister should say to the people. The time for illusions is over. The time for decisions has arrived. We love the entire land of our forefathers, and at some other time we would have wanted to live here alone. But that will not happen. The Arabs, too, have dreams and needs. Between the Jordan and the Mediterranean, there is no longer a clear Jewish majority, and so, fellow citizens, it is not possible to keep the whole thing without paying a price. We cannot keep a Palestinian majority under an Israeli boot and at the same time think ourselves the only democracy in the Middle East. There cannot be democracy without equal rights for all who live here, Arab as well as Jew. We cannot keep the territories and preserve a Jewish majority in the world's only Jewish state, not by means that are humane and moral and Jewish. Do you want the greater land of Israel? No problem. Abandon democracy. Let's institute an efficient system of racial separation here with prison camps and detention villages. Do you want a Jewish majority? No problem. Either put the Arabs on railway cars, buses, camels, and donkeys and expel them en masse, or separate ourselves from them absolutely, without tricks and gimmicks. There is no middle path. We must remove all the settlements, all of them, and draw an internationally recognized border between the Jewish national home and the Palestinian national home. The Jewish law of return will apply only within our national home, and their right of return will apply only within the borders of the Palestinian state. Do you want democracy? No problem. Either abandon the greater land of Israel to the last settlement and outpost, or give full citizenship and voting rights to everyone, including Arabs. The result, of course, will be that those who did not want a Palestinian state alongside us will have one in our midst, via the ballot box. The Prime Minister should present the choices forthrightly, Jewish racism or democracy, settlements or hope for both peoples, false visions of barbed wire and suicide bombers, or a recognized international border between two states and a shared capital in Jerusalem. Why, then, is the opposition so quiet? Perhaps because some would like to join the government at any price, even the price of participating in the sickness. But while they dither, the forces of good lose hope. Anyone who declines to present a clear-cut position, black or white, is collaborating in the decline. It is not a matter of labor versus Likud, or right versus left, but of right versus wrong, acceptable versus unacceptable, the law-abiding versus lawbreakers. What's needed is not a political replacement for the Sharon-owned government, but a vision of hope, an alternative to the destruction of Zionism and its values by the deaf, dumb, and callous. Israel's friends abroad, Jewish and non-Jewish alike, presidents and prime ministers, rabbis and laypeople, should choose as well. They must reach out and help Israel to navigate the roadmap toward our national destiny as a light unto the nations and a society of peace, justice, and equality. Under pressure, coffee giant P&G will start to offer a fair trade line. Small-scale coffee farmers around the world scored a victory this week when Procter & Gamble, the largest seller of coffee in the U.S., announced that it would introduce fair trade certified coffee products through its specialty coffee division, Millstone. The announcement comes in response to dialogue with shareholders about the company's practices, as well as pressure from consumers, people of faith, human rights activists, and humanitarian organizations. With P&G's announcement that it will offer fair trade certified coffee through Millstone, the advocacy group have agreed to suspend their campaigns against the corporation, and the shareholders have withdrawn the resolution they had filed on the issue. With world market prices as low as they are right now, we see that many coffee farmers cannot maintain their families and their land anymore. We need fair trade now more than ever, says Geronimo Bolin, director of Manos Campesinas, a fair trade certified coffee cooperative in Guatemala. Over the past 3 years, the price of coffee has fallen almost 50% and now hovers near a 30-year low. This has resulted in a widespread humanitarian crisis for 25 million coffee-growing families in over 50 developing countries. Unable to cover their cost of production, small farmers cannot earn the incomes necessary to feed their families, send their children to school, purchase essential medicines, and stay on their land. Grown by democratically organized cooperatives, Fairtrade certified coffee guarantees farmers a minimum of $1.26 a pound for their harvest. Last month, the International Coffee Organization composite indicator average price for green coffee was 52 cents a pound. P&G's action is an excellent example of what can be accomplished through the collaboration of shareholder activists and nonprofit organizations. It's a win-win for the world's small-scale coffee farmers, for the environment, and for P&G itself, said Sister Ruth Rosenbaum, Executive Director of the Center for Reflection, Education, and Action. CREA and Domini Social Investments led the shareholder dialogue with P&G. We brought very serious concerns to P&G, and after considerable dialogue, the company was willing to take action. This dialogue continues, and we've achieved a working relationship with P&G that we expect will lead to further constructive action. With this decision, P&G, one of the four largest coffee companies in the world, joins an impressive list of over 200 coffee companies that currently offer fair trade certified coffee in the U.S. Procter & Gamble's Millstone will immediately offer fair trade certified coffee to wholesale accounts, universities, restaurants, etc., and to consumers through its website, www.millstone.com. P&G is committed to build significant consumer demand for fair trade certified coffee. This commitment is planned to result in P&G becoming a leading U.S. buyer of fair trade certified coffee, which would represent purchases of at least 2 to 3 million pounds per year, based on today's estimates. More farmers than ever before will now receive a fair price for their harvest, said Deborah James, Global Exchange. By providing a floor price, fair trade enables farmers to make a dignified living while providing new opportunities to cultivate high-quality, environmentally sustainable coffee. Domini is pleased that Procter & Gamble has become one of the world's largest coffee companies to retail fair trade certified coffee, said Adam Conzer, Director of Shareholder Advocacy for Domini Social Investments, the manager of the Domini Social Equity Fund. This is a small step forward, but a significant one. It is encouraging that as a major coffee company, P&G is willing to give fair trade certified coffee a chance and to put marketing dollars behind it. P&G's management has demonstrated a willingness to address serious, complex inequities in the market with forward-thinking action. Procter & Gamble's decision is a critical step to help make trade fair for the world's 25 million coffee-growing families who continue to face destitution and ruin. Oxfam challenges global giants Kraft and Nestle, as well as the U.S. government, to take immediate steps to address the structural inequities that trap coffee farmers in a cycle of poverty, said Liam Brody of Oxfam. With coffee prices so low, it is more important now than ever that coffee drinkers always ask for fair trade certified coffee, said Aaron Gorman of Co-op America. Over the course of the last 2 years, a range of shareholder and advocacy groups has each engaged Procter & Gamble on the issue of fair trade coffee. At the October 2001 P&G shareholder meeting, Global Exchange called on P&G to begin offering fair trade certified coffee. In September 2002, Oxfam launched its What's That in Your Coffee campaign, which called on the world's major coffee roasters, including Kraft Foods, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, and Sara Lee, to increase the market for fair trade coffee, to bring the current oversupply of coffee back into line with demand, and to help ensure that coffee farmers are able to earn a decent living. In December 2002, Domini and CREA led a coalition of investors holding more than 500,000 shares of P&G in a dialogue with the company about purchasing fair trade coffee. In April 2003, the shareholder coalition filed with Procter & Gamble the first-ever shareholder resolution to address the coffee crisis. Meanwhile, Co-op America, the Interfaith Fair Trade Initiative, Oxfam, and Global Exchange all educated and encouraged concerned citizens to urge the company to begin selling fair trade certified coffee. Shareholders and NGOs cautioned that they will hold Procter & Gamble to its promises and continue to monitor its progress. We're glad that Procter & Gamble is making this first-step commitment to fair trade and look forward to the day when it commits to paying farmers a decent price for all its coffee, like the coffee companies that pioneered fair trade, said Sarah Ford of the Interfaith Fair Trade Initiative. Nike backs off in Right to Lie sweatshop case. Nike said today that although it has settled the suit brought against it by California consumer activist Mark Caskey, it still intends to curtail its corporate PR efforts, including the continued suspension of its social responsibility reporting initiative, PR Week reports. Despite the settlement, which was announced this morning, Nike said it does not plan to ramp up the PR activities that have been curtailed because of the pending lawsuit. Nike has also decided not to issue its corporate responsibility report for fiscal year 2002. The suit stemmed from a Nike campaign to defend itself from charges that it used sweatshop labor. Caskey sued Nike in 1998 under California Truth in Advertising laws, saying Nike's claims were false. Nike said its statements on its overseas factories are protected speech. The California Supreme Court, however, disagreed with Nike, saying its campaign did qualify as commercial speech. The U.S. Supreme Court decided not to rule on Nike's appeal. Nike admits no liability with the settlement that will see $1.5 million going to the Fair Labor Association. You have been listening to Lover Alternative News.